Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take for women veterans to feel at home again after serving their country in overseas conflict zones? Although women make up about 14% of the active duty U.S. military population today, the Veterans Administration is still working to convert its facilities and programs to cater appropriately to the needs of female vets. My guest today is determined to ensure that women who have risked their lives to serve their country get the help they need to reintegrate into civilian life, to find housing and gainful employment, and to cope with any mental health challenges or relationship problems brought on by their service. Kim Olson retired as a colonel from the U.S. Air Force. Today, she serves as president and CEO of the not-for-profit organization Grace After Fire, which works to provide women veterans with knowledge, insight, and self-renewal as they reintegrate into their communities following active duty. Kim, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how do the needs of returning women veterans compare with those of their male counterparts?
Well, women are different than men, so it would be logical to think that women would have different needs. Women tend to be the center of their family. They're the nucleus of the family. So they go off, they wear a uniform, they go in harm's way, and then they come home. And now they have to reintegrate back into their families as mothers, as wives, as daughters, as sisters. And a lot of times women tend to be the big community workers, too. We're the volunteers. We do a lot of the soft skills, if you will. And so sometimes I think women have a bad habit of taking care of everybody else first and themselves last. And this is tough on women vets. And one of the things we try to teach our women in their self-renewal is you got to be a little selfish when you get back, even though it's been difficult being away from your family for 6, 7, 8, sometimes 18 months at a time.
We know this is an issue for men who are dads and husbands, but it seems like women who are wives and mothers, do they deal with a greater amount of sort of guilt for having been separated from their families?
Well, I can only speak from a personal point of view, and I missed six of my, when I was in the military, 12 of my daughter's birthdays. Mm-hmm. So you betcha.
Yeah.
And what's interesting and what I think if a woman vet is out there, and we need to learn that when you deploy, you sort of compartmentalize your world. When you are deployed, you're in the zone, the combat zone or whatever zone you're in. And so those emotions that are very intuitive for women, love and caring and empathy and passion, kind of get dialed down and get shut off. And so you kind of have to do it for survival. So you're out, you're deployed, you're working, you're here with mostly men, and emotions get put in check. And then all of a sudden, 18 hours later, you're home, because that's about how long it takes a flight. And you come off the airplane, and there's that great scene where the mother is embracing the child and the husband and the family. And all of a sudden, it's like, where are those feelings? And you think you're kind of nuts, because you can't find those feelings anymore. They're hard to come by. And what we tell our women is you had to dial them down, and you got to dial them back up. It takes a while to get kind of in touch with those emotions again that are, of course, natural to us. And so for women, I think reintegrating back into the family as a loving, caring woman, some women find that really hard to do. They lose a bit of their femininity. They lose what's makes them a woman, because that's not really quite what you want in a soldier. It's nice to have passion. It's nice to have compassion. But those aren't elements that we train to if you ever watch our training. So it's tough on women.
I've also wondered about this, Kim, because there are a lot of families and a lot of communities where guys who are returning home will have a friend from high school or the neighborhood or a brother or a dad who has served. And because the numbers are so skewed, it seems like it might be harder for women to have a close friend who understands what she's just been through.
I mean, to your point earlier, Chris, that women only make up about, depending on what unit you're in, 15 to 18% of the service. So it's still not unusual to have a woman be the only one in her company or in her unit. And so as you come back into society, you might be the only gal in town that volunteered to serve in your country, for your country. And so to come back and then try to find what we call a battle buddy, or a gal that kind of has been there and walked in your boots and can get it without a bunch of explanation, it might be difficult for some of these gals. And that's why Grace After Fire comes in, because we have an online system. You go to something called Grace Garden, graceafterfire.org, and we have Grace Garden. And you can talk to other women veterans who've been to Afghanistan, who have been to Iraq, or have been in the Navy, or been in the Marines. And you can sort of have that discussion with them about what you're going through or what you're feeling with somebody who gets it. And so, because it's really, it's kind of like labor. Unless you've been there, it's really hard to explain. time. And so that's important for women. And again, women don't look like vets. I mean, when you picture a veteran in your head, and this is, again, one of the reasons I think the Veterans Administration so struggles, because it's built around a 60-year-old male model. Now, let's think about a 60-year-old guy. He's at the twilight of his career. He's got probably a spouse who can get him to appointments. His children have moved out of the house. And he maybe has time to go sit in a waiting room somewhere. Let's contrast that with today's female vet. 60% of them are under the age of 30. So a 30-year-old woman has children at home. She still has a career she's trying to pursue, might be in school trying to, you know, take on these great benefits that the post 9/11 GI Bill has offered our troops. And she may or may not be married. And so she has a whole different platform or a whole different set of circumstances on her plate to the male counterpart. And as try as it might, the VA system just has not moved fast enough for what these women have encountered. And the other thing I think it's important for our listeners to know is that 250,000 women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's sort of this perfect storm of a lot of women for the first time in our nation's history that have seen combat. One, because both wars have been so long, and two, because one in every five recruit from the military is a female. So you have this sort of budding, you know, populace of women who've served in our military today.
And there was a time when you could meet a female member of the military and assume that although her work was vital, she probably had been shielded from the worst realities of combat. And today, with the way war works, we can't know that at all.
Well, we have a saying that if you served in an organization with mostly men, you've been in combat all the time. But I understand your point, Chris, is yes, the battle lines are now blurred. You know, ask the folks on 9/11. And so when you deploy into country, you are in combat. From the minute you step on that tarmac, you're in combat. And so the fact she happens to drive a bus or be a food service inspector or works in the admin room, it really doesn't matter. If you are in uniform today and you deploy, you are in harm's way. And so women today have seen things that, at least in my generation, the women that kind of opened all these doors for gals. And that's sort of what drives me, if I get off on a little trail here, is my generation with gray hair or chemically altered gray hair kind of blew the doors off the hinges for these women in most walks of life, the baby boomers, to be in combat and to serve their nation in whatever capacity that their talents could bring them to. And that what's important and what kind of drives me is to make sure that there's a safety net under them to catch them if they do go in harm's way and something happens to them, that there is a system to take care of the female vets, just like there's a system to take care of our male vets.
How does PTSD manifest itself in women as compared with men?
Well, it's just logical that women are not little men. I don't care what kind of uniform you put on them or shoes.
Or curvy men.
We're just not. And so we process trauma differently. We process war differently. And therefore, it is logical to think, well, the protocols to making us well or moving through that experience would be different. And again, that's why it's important to have a system that can recognize that and offer different counseling sessions or different types of medication if that's what required, or different types of, you know, recovery systems. And we do that at Grace After Fire. We have a peer-to-peer that works with just women. It's built around the woman's psyche, around emotional intelligence. And a good example is when a male, and I'm going to generalize here, sees an event in country, they are traumatized about the event. The ID went off, the bomb went, I lost my battle buddy, whatever it is. Women tend to be traumatized around the relationship, that something happened in the relationship. And I hate to get in on the subject, but you can't talk about women vets without talking about military sexual trauma. And that's why it's so devastating for women in the field to be taken advantage of, because it is a betrayal of the relationship. Your battle buddy you would have died for, but that doesn't mean he gets to take advantage of you. Your commander, you would have followed his orders no matter what he said, but that doesn't mean he, again, can take advantage of you. And if they do, it is a tremendous betrayal of that trust and camaraderie and you know, integrity that you're supposed to share within your combat units or within your units as it is. So women don't act out like a male. With you hear a lot about PTSD and men acting out. They speed, they drink, they try to get that adrenaline rush. A lot of times and again, I'm not a psychiatrist, but what they tell us is that women process information and we tend to shove it down and we, you know, set it down until it kind of becomes nightmares at night, or it manifests itself where we can't sleep, or we can't seem to stop crying, or whatever, you know, our experience in working with Grace with women, these are the things that we've seen. And so what we try to work with our women, we say, you got to deal with it. And it's not, you know, three cups of wine and some, you know, Ambient later. No, you got to deal with whatever the issue is and move it from the emotional side where it's triggering an emotional reaction to you in your brain and in your body, and move it just to the memory bank. And that's kind of what the theories of cognitive processing theory are talking about, is something that stimulates you such that the adrenaline rushes and you get a, you know, you see a trash bag along the side of I-30 and you go zinging across three lanes of traffic. Well, what keeps you alive in country will get you in big trouble in the United States. So you cannot do that. But it doesn't mean the body doesn't react to it, because that's what it was programmed to do for a whole year. So we try to deprogram, if you will, or what they do is they have a checklist. Okay, are you in Iraq? No. Is that probably an ID? No. You know, and you just sort of deprogram yourself. And after a while, the body will stop physically reacting to events.
So this peer-to-peer counseling that you facilitate at Grace After Fire, this is not psychiatric professionals. How do you train the mentors that are participating in this?
That's a great question. We have facilitator training. And again, to your point, we're not psychiatrists, we're not psychologists, we're not clinicians. We are other veterans. Almost all of us have been deployed to one of the two zones, who have experience in, you know, dealing with other female vets. We screen our facilitators, and the peer-to-peer is gone through the states. Department of Health and Human Services have looked at the peer-to-peer model, and it's all evidence-based, most of the stuff. So, you know, I like to plagiarize anything. So we take another project that has worked, and we just integrate it for the veteran themselves. And as an example, back to the military sexual trauma, if you're working with someone, you're a psychiatrist, and you're working with someone who, you know, had a bad experience in the field, and if you treat that experience as if it was a stranger rape on the side of the street or some kind of violent crime, you're going to miss the whole point. Mm-hmm. You need to treat it as if it were incest, because that's what it's like for them. But if you don't know that, because you don't understand the type of relationships that people have in the military, you're going to miss the boat on getting our female vet well. So if you're dealing with military sexual trauma out there, you have to understand that, why she didn't report him, why she didn't, you know, say no, because it's a different relationship. Again, it's a matter of trust and camaraderie that these folks have. So back to the peer-to-peer, we have facilitators that get trained. It's a eight block session that we do, and they're volunteers, and the training is, again, looked at by the state. We've worked on stuff. We have a Bring It In the Zone, which is very similar, family resilience. There's a lot out there, but it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And what the best thing is, and what we're kind of trying to do at Grace, is we want it to be a grassroots movement. If you want to help vets, you want to help women vets, and you think you have a living room, you could have six women sit in your living room and serve some iced tea and some yummy cookies and sit there and just let them talk about whatever happened. Because here's the deal, Chris, women have all these words and we got to kind of use them up in one day, or I think our heads explode. But that's how women stress. And back to your point about how men and women are different, you know, a man will go into a session, he'll yak for 20 minutes and he's good to go. A woman wants an hour, a box of Kleenex, and one person to tell her story to. She doesn't want a whole crowd. And so it's just how we, again, de-stress is different than our male counterpart. And we're just as resilient as our male counterparts. I want to make that point out there.
Retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Kim Olson is my guest. She's president and CEO of the not-for-profit organization Grace After Fire. We'll return to our discussion of serving the needs of women returning home from active duty military in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Kim Olson, who is president and CEO of the not-for-profit organization Grace After Fire. We're talking about serving the needs of women returning home from active duty military service. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Kim, I want to go back to this question of sexual violence. On top of everything else that our women in the military are coping with, do we know anything about the percentages of women who face this when they are serving their country?
Well, it depends on what research you look at. The VA will tell you 1 in 5 report military sexual trauma, but that's the 1 in 5 that go to the VA. I've seen numbers 1 in 3. That's kind of disheartening as a senior officer thinking, oh, man, really, still in 2012, our young women are dealing with this in the field. I think the only way that's going to stop sexual trauma in the military is that men say, not in my Army, not in my Marines, not in my Air Force, not in my Navy, are we going to attack our fellow soldiers, male or female? Mm-hmm. And that's how you can't put it, the weight of that, on the female. Number one, she tends to be enlisted, young, not have the power, sounds all familiar, in the service. And so to say, okay, it's all up to you to make the complaint or file, I mean, that's just ridiculous. And of course, you see they've sued now. The DOD has been sued around the inaction of senior officers. But given I'm a senior officer and, you know, would take that very seriously in the units I commanded, it's just, you have to set the precedent that this just will not occur in our service, in our unit, in our brigade, in our wing. It just will not be tolerated, period.
Is the percentage of leadership that is female in the military today commensurate with that 15% to 18% that you mentioned of women serving?
No, because, and again, the military is a closed personnel system. Everybody enters as an airman. Everybody enters as a young lieutenant, and you work your way within the system. Nobody intersects it anywhere.
Right.
So those of us that entered in early 80s, you know, we would be the rank of, you know, 4-star generals right now. And so that was a small group that entered, and as it's kind of a bubble group, and it's bubbling up. But we weren't 15% when I came in. So as the service matures, if you will, with the number of women running through it, then as you bubble up to the top, you'll see those numbers increase. But right now, it's a very tight and steep pyramid where we will finally get our first 4-star female Air Force general. We've had an Army one, but, you know, it took almost 30 years to get that. So, no, we aren't represented at all. And it's not the military. It's kind of that way around. If you look at CEOs in the public, if you look at superintendents, if you look at heads of hospitals and, you know, corporate boards, we aren't represented commensurate with what, you know, the population is by any stretch.
Can we learn anything about taking care of female veterans from military systems in other parts of the world where the numbers of men and women are closer to 50-50?
Well, Israel is a good example.
Yeah.
But again, they have a you must serve 2 years. Everybody does when they're a very small country and they can do that. I personally believe you ought to give back to the nation that you were born in or that you became a citizen in some type of service. Doesn't have to be military, but you know, work for the forestry or work for, you know, some type of federal agency or state agency if you're going to be here. That's just my personal opinion. But our service is very small today. And so I think the thing you can learn, again, that large pool, if you will, that 250,000 women who've seen combat, it's kind of a great control group around research for what can work best for women. So you have this young force of women under 30, like I talked about, who've been in harm's way, who've experienced war like our male counterparts, but will react differently. And so if you can learn anything from that pool of women, you could probably apply it to the general sector around maybe depression, around traumatic brain injury, around injuries to the body. And why not take that great research and then apply it to the general female populace as a whole? We know that today, I didn't know it at the time, but women who serve in the military are prone to osteoporosis at a very young age. Hmm. Well, if we know that, then let's get you on vitamin D at an early age. Let's get you on calcium at an early age so you don't have that when you're only 40 years old. We know that some of the skeletal stresses of the body, the back, because again, our military doesn't have the armor plating that's built for a woman. It's flat. So what happens, you know, I don't tell you, your audience about the anatomy of women, but what they do then is they loosen the strap that's on their shoulder, and then the plates hang forward, which cause your rounding of shoulders and cause you to have back and neck injuries. Well, that's silly. Let's get the armor, you know. Not Xena the Warrior kind of armor, but, you know, armor that is cut out for a woman so she can have the protective armor close to her body and not put stresses on her back. And I would argue that would apply to your police force, to your special ops guys that go out, to some of the units that have women in them in the general sector.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. And first on the line, we have Wes speaking in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wes.
How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Well, while I was listening, she answered my question, but I brought up another one. I just my wife is a big proponent of everyone serving, man and woman, for at least 2 years in our service. And I think it's important because the long deployment recently showed that we were having to use those in the service for too long a time. Too many people coming back around to go on another deployment. The other thing I was wondering about was I wanted to say that I think I agree entirely with her saying the men have to stand up for the women in the service. They have to get in there, and just like they would fall on a grenade for their buddy, they've got to stand up and say the right thing.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Wes.
I was astonished to read about unemployment rates for women as compared with men. We've heard that it's tough for vets to come back, but why is it worse now for women veterans than for men?
Well, kind of to my very first point, Chris, where a woman will come in and take care of everybody else first and herself last. So the woman comes back to the household and she's got to reintegrate as the mom, kind of reestablish herself as the nucleus of the family. And so she's got to get the kids lined up, got to get the relationship with the husband back, got to get the extended family, you know, back and moving. And so a lot of times she waits to go and seek a job. And then the further you're away from working, you know, the harder it is to go get a job. That's number one. Number two is that even in 2012 today in America, women only make 78 cents on the dollar. And that is really hard on a female vet because in the military, this is one of the best things we do. We have absolute parity in our pay. An E4 female makes the same amount of money as an E4 male. And so when she gets out of the military and she tries to find a job commensurate with like her male counterpart, she'll make $10,000 less a year. That's a lot of money if you're in the $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 tax bracket, which a lot are, you know, economic segment. That's a lot of money for our female vets. And so that's a house payment. That's child care. And that brings me to the second point, child care. You know, 40% to 50% of our women vets are moms. So I can't beam in to Dallas, Texas, set up an apartment, find somebody to take care of my kid, and then go out and look for a job. I got to come back where I've got a support structure around me that can watch my child while I go back to school, when I go search for jobs. You know, that's when I go have my VA appointments and try to, you know, do whatever recovery that I need to do. It's very, very challenging for us. And then the last thing is women, unfortunately, have about a five times higher rate of becoming homeless. And it's not because of what we've seen in the past where we have mental health issues, where we have substance abuse issues. It's around economics. And it makes sense. If I'm going to make 10 grand less than my male counterpart, and I can't translate my skill sets easily into the civilian world, it makes it tough for me. But here, I have to make this point. It concerns me that a lot of times in the press, vets are portrayed as, you know, especially with this latest thing in Afghanistan, that we all got PTSD, that we're all suffering some mental health issues. And that's just not the case. War is a terrible thing. It's the best that humanity can bring out, and it shows you the worst of humanity. And anybody that goes to war is changed. Anybody tells you they go to war and come back not changed, they're not being truthful with you. It's just you have to translate that experience and put it in its proper perspective and then get on with the business of being, you know, an American here in this country. And so for us, I think it's so important for the public to know that work makes warriors well. If you offer them the greatest new drug, you know, known to mankind, and a job that can sustain their family, they'll take the job every single time. And that's what I think America can do for its vets. Yes, it's nice to greet us at the airport. Yes, it's nice to have parades. Yes, it's nice to have the flag and the bumper stickers. But give us a job. We will make ourselves well. We will contribute back to our communities long after we take off our uniforms. So that's the best thing that American can do for its men and women who've served in this country.
How do you think the message has not been conveyed with appropriate subtlety to the extent that a lot of people think of returning veterans as sort of damaged goods?
Well, I don't think we're damaged goods. I think that we have such a different force than what we had, let's say, in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. The force in Vietnam was young. You were in and out. You did your one time, and then you're back again. Today's military, there are two things that made today's military the most professional and best trained force ever, I think. Even the Roman legions, we were better than them. Two things. One is an all-volunteer force, which we've had for several, a couple decades now. And two was the integration of women. Because here's what women did in the military is they raised the bar. They made everyone better by just being there. Their presence changed behavior. Alcohol was deglamorized. A lot of things happened. The family got brought into the fold now that even when I was a commander, that was so cutting edge to even think about the family left behind. Now we have complete programs around the family resiliency, yellow ribbon stuff. And so I think it's important to know that we have a very well-trained force, and we have asked them to do a lot in this last decade, multiple deployments for long periods of time, and they have done it superbly. And so I think, again, America needs to remember only 1% of the nation serves in uniform. And thank goodness it's only 1%. I mean, the cost to have a huge standing military to this country would be devastating. So it's fabulous that we only have 1% that have to serve in uniform today. So the 99% of us can, again, go about on our lives. But us 99% of us now, I think, in a way, have an obligation to the 1%. And those companies that benefit from the capitalist society, which we believe in this country, get out there and hire a vet and be purposeful in it. Don't just hang a sign out saying, we're veteran friendly. Get out there, get your HR person and go find the vets and hire them and get them into your company. And the great thing is, if I'm talking to people who hire, look, those veterans come with some of the best education benefits ever seen in this nation. I mean, they come to you with a check in their back pocket signed by the government saying, hire me part-time or hire me full-time, and I will go to school and somebody else will pay on it. What a great thing for companies today.
Do you think that, first of all, does the VA have job placement services for returning veterans?
The VA does disability. So that's its one side. There's two sides of the VA. Everybody thinks the VA is all about medical, but one side is that the VA does disability. So it does ratings and it gives people money if they have a service-connected disability. And then the other side of the VA is the medical care. If you're hurt, if you're injured, if it's a service-connected injury, they have an obligation to help care for you. The Texas Veterans Texas Veterans Commission. Okay. Embedded in it, and most states have this, mm-hmm. Chris, have a way to help place veterans. You get points. Some will announce the job before the public can see it for the veterans. But I think veterans today need help in translating those skill sets they learned overseas to today's marketplace. And I think that's where a gap is. And that's where we see this huge unemployment rate, especially in the ages from 18 to 24, is that we struggle in translating driving a truck. I mean, that sounds like it could be translating, or, being point on a patrol. I mean, those kinds of things I think sometimes are difficult to translate in today's marketplace. And we need to be able to do that. We need to show employers how these guys, A, they show up, B, they're disciplined, C, they're loyal, D, they are trainable because they've been screened. I mean, there's a lot of things that veterans can bring to the table. And the big deal is they'll make your bottom line bigger. And that's what you want. I mean, you're a profit-driven company, so hire a vet. They raise the bar just like they did in the military.
So as to the idea of something like driving a truck, and there are millions of other jobs that people mm-hmm. do, or thousands, we should say. But my understanding is that people come back and they have these skills, but they are not certified to do that work for a commercial organization. Do you think that changing laws to make it easier for veterans to have certifications based on their military experience would make a difference?
Well, sure it will, because if I'm driving a truck in Afghanistan or Iraq and I'm dodging IEDs and I'm doing this, do you think I could not drive an 18-wheeler on I-30? So if we could certify them to have a CDL, I think is the
licensing.
There you go. Pulled that out. A CDL for them overseas. Why not do that? Now, the VA or the benefits that you get, the education benefits that you get, will pay for that schooling if you want to go. But if I got to feed my family, that's tough to go to school for a couple months to get whatever training's up. But again, veterans have tremendous benefits today. I mean, they really do, and they really should take advantage of them. And that's a lot of times the vets are like, I just want to go home and just be normal again, which you're never going to be. You're going to be who you are. But you need to take about 3 to 6 months off, if that's what it takes, and then get back at it. Again, work will make you well. And whether you're working towards some type of degree, some type of certification, whether you're working on your relationship, whether you're working on being a mom or a dad again, you got to work at it. Because if you sit, again, research shows if you stay involved in something, you will accelerate your recovery or your reintegration back into American society.
How does that reintegration process affect the success rate of long-term relationships, people who are partnered up for life? Is it a big divorce risk to come back from overseas?
Well, unfortunately, the divorce rate right now in the services are pretty high, mm-hmm. as are the suicide rate. Those are two stats that are very disturbing.
Yeah.
And I think that's, if you would peel that onion back a little bit, you would see that the high divorce rate is around multiple deployments. That it is really tough on those families left behind that, you know, he goes off or she goes off and she's, I mean, everything is taken care of for her or him when they deploy. It's, mm-hmm. you know, when to get up, you know, when you're going to eat, you know, what you're going to wear, you know, what you're doing every single day. And it's kind of like Groundhog Day every day. And it's the spouse or the partner that's left behind that has to deal with life. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because, you know, they're sort of on these opposite waves, we call it. I remember calling back to my husband and all I want to know is about house stuff. Oh, tell me about this and tell me about that. And then all he wanted to know was about what I was doing overseas. And I don't want to tell you that because I got to live it every day.
Yeah.
You know, tell me about my kids. Tell me about the household. Tell me about, you know, just tell me about the car. Did it have a flat tire? Just tell me normal life things because I don't get any of that overseas. But today's kids, they're kids, they're young. To me, they're young. It's just instant gratification. I have two brothers that are in Afghanistan right now, both of them, both over 50, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
They were teasing they were going to start an AARP unit out there.
You know what? Let me jump in. I want you to be able to tell the story, but we need to take a quick break.
My guest is
retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Kim Olson, president and CEO of the not-for-profit organization Grace After Fire. We'll come back to our discussion of serving the needs of women returning home from active duty military service in a moment. Our number, 1-800-933-5377.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kim Olson. She retired as a colonel from the U.S. Air Force and now is president and CEO of the not-for-profit organization Grace After Fire. If you'd like to join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Kim, you were telling us you have two brothers-in-law who are mm-hmm. actively serving right now.
Right. They're in Afghanistan. And what's interesting is the access to instant communications with them, which was different than when I was deployed just less than 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so this morning, you know, we're up on Skype and we're talking to one of the brother-in-laws out there. And that's a good thing and a bad thing because the family can stay connected with the spouse or the husband or the mom overseas. But then the stresses of home can, you know, get integrated into while they're deployed. So it's sort of this double-edged coin, if you will, around contact with the families.
Talk about the ways that the VA specifically is beginning to evolve its services. And I'm especially curious about whether comprehensive services are available in every VA clinic or if women sometimes have to travel farther than men.
And that's the complaint around women is that the care is so fragmented. And it depends on which VA service you go to and what happens in the the circle of policy in D.C. sometimes doesn't translate into practice out here in the centers. And so, and I'm going to pick on the Dallas VA right here, you know, try as they might. And if you've ever been to the Dallas VA and you walk into their lobby area, if you don't have PTSD, you'll have it by the time you get there. It's a stressful place. Overwhelming. I mean, it's just a sensory overload. Yeah. I mean, I really feel for these young troops that are coming back. And a lot of women will send somebody with them just to get through the doors because it's pretty intimidating. And so they have a woman's clinic there. It's only open a couple days a week, which is tough because you have to wait a long time. But good for the VA. They now have sort of these brackets. You've got to be able to be seen within a certain amount of days, or they send you off contract with someone else. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, you know, the VA wasn't built around a female model. There are hospitals out here who've been doing women for a long time. Yeah. Why don't you just contract with a hospital that is a woman's clinic, that has docs, that's been dealing with this kind of stuff, and just let them do it? But instead, you know, the VA is kind of brick and mortar because that's where they get their budget and that's where they get their money. And so now they're going to try to build a woman's clinic over at the VA. And you're like, okay, well, 7 years later, I guess. But Fort Worth has a clinic. And it's a woman's clinic, comprehensive. Instead of having just a nurse practitioner, they actually have an internist there. Doc Rogers works there. And so you can get just about everything there. And it's beautiful. It's set aside. It's waiting room you don't share with anyone. It's quiet. You can get in and out of there without traversing, you know, sort of this, you know, arduous landscape that some of the other VAs have. And women tend to like it. And you can have almost, you can get just about every kind of care you need there, which I think is important because, again, if I'm a mom, I can't get an appointment at 8:30 in the morning because guess what? I'm getting kids off to school, right? And I can't stay any later than about 2:30 because you don't want kids coming home, you know, alone and unafraid. And so I've got this really tight window which I can have an appointment during the week. And, oh, by the way, I got to take off work or school. And so, again, the VA's just sort of got to change how it treats this particular group of veterans, because again, they're trying to work, sustain families, go to school, and maybe you need a Saturday morning appointment. Maybe you need after hours type of stuff.
What kind of help is available to families during the absence of their sister, mother, wife, and then after when these women are coming home in order to stay whole and doing well?
Well, it depends on what unit has deployed. A lot of units, and it's their responsibility, have family programs for the families. The problem sometimes we see is that a lot of times people go out as ones and twos. They become, my brother-in-law is a good example. He's a Texas State Guard guy, and he's up with the Wisconsin Engineering Battalion, and he's deployed to Afghanistan. So he doesn't have any kind of support back here, although sometimes the units call and say, hey, you guys doing okay? I mean, that's the kind of thing that you need. Active duty guys have tremendous support structures around them. If a whole base deploys, like my other brother-in-law, his unit went, entire units go, then that base and all the wives get together and they support one another. The trouble is when you have them kind of alone all by themselves, or the guard and the reserve guy who doesn't, or gal, who doesn't have a good support system around them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Back to the phones now. This time we have Vincent on the line in Dallas. Hey, Vincent.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
Kim, right now I'm a part of a clinical pastoral education psychotherapy class, and I was just wondering, what's the best way for us here locally in the Dallas area to plug in with you guys and give the veterans a place to come over, you know, once or twice a week? To sit around and talk and, you know, read some scripture and drink some coffee.
Well, thank you for your work with veterans. And he brings up a really good point. And Vince, you can go to our website and send a message to Stacy. She is our Dallas outreach coordinator right here, and connect with us that way. I have outreach coordinators with Grace After Fire at the high population areas. We have two here, Fort Worth and Dallas. We have one in San Antonio. I just got one down in Houston. We just came out of Killeen, because those are the high population areas of women vets that we know of. And just in case your readers don't know, or your listeners don't know, we have 158,000 female vets in the state of Texas, 25,000 right here in North Dallas. And I think it's really important, his point of spiritual renewal. You know, you can fix the body, you can fix the psychology of going to war, but I think, and from personal experience, I'll just share that I think the hardest part is that spiritual healing. The things you see, the things that sometimes you have to do, don't settle well in your head. And sometimes you've got to come to terms with that. And so his point is very, very well taken, that at the end of the day, you know, sometimes it just takes that spiritual healing to get you through that final sweeping of the glass, as you will.
Back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have, I believe it's John on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, John.
That's right, Chris, and respectfully, Colonel Olson.
Hey, John.
I was at the Tarrant County Family Courthouse on the first floor the other day, and they have a workforce connection there. And what I really appreciated, and I think you'll appreciate, and I hope your listeners will appreciate, there was a sign that says, veterans welcome, or veteran friendly. And it's a good place for, you know, to get help with your resume, to get job connections. Years ago, I got laid off from Lockheed, and they sent the people through it's a thing that helps you connect with job connections. So when I saw the veteran friendly and I heard what you're doing, I wanted to mention that to as many people as possible.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, John.
Do you think when organizations say we need to hire some veterans, do they think men?
Probably. You know, it's interesting. I think companies want to do right by vets. I really do. There's a consortium of HR professionals that get together, and one of the things they're talking about is hiring veterans and how do you hire them, and what is it they need as far as training or getting acclimated to the corporate mindset. And the military, when you retire, when you leave the military after an extended service, you go through a TAP program, which is a transition assistance program. And it was kind of death by PowerPoint slides. It really was. I was like, oh my gosh. And I
went well-meaning, but
yeah, you're just like, oh my gosh. So, and I went through executive one. I was like, oh, mercy. And so I think they're changing that to exactly what John was saying, is that you need to be able to translate your resume and change the lingo and the acronyms to something that the corporations can understand, and see how again, these tremendous skill sets that these veterans bring to the table, how they can translate to your improving your bottom line. And I think that the military should be a little more proactive in helping translate folks from the military sector, even though that's not one of their core missions, but helping them translate into the corporate work, or, you know, not-for-profit work like you and I are in.
Do you mind speaking just a little bit, Kim? You mentioned having missed, I guess, birthdays and big things as when you were a mom. Can you talk a little bit about what it took each time you came back to sort of get back to the heart of your family?
Well, it was exactly what I talked about earlier. I'm a pilot. That was what my MOS, as we call it, training was. And I was flying for nearly 20 years of my 25-year career. And so pilots, we compartmentalize our world. You know, climb into the cockpit and you strap that baby on and you fly. And all you're doing is flying. I mean, your whole world disappears.
You have to focus on
it. Yeah, because you got to focus on it. Trust me, you want pilots focused. And so you really keep yourself in check because you're the pilot, and they don't like crying in the cockpit. It's just not a good thing. It makes everybody nervous. But, you know, you really became void of any emotion because of, you know, engine caught on fire or something bad happened. You had to be just focused on flying the airframe. And I would imagine, I'm not a foot soldier and I'm not on a naval ship, and I imagine it's the same thing. You compartmentalize your world. But my flights were an hour or 8 hours or however long, and then I landed. And then, boom, I could uncompartmentalize my world and go back and be the mom. But when you deploy, you can't use that same technique. And so you really shut yourself down emotionally. And I can remember coming home and, oh, I was so excited to see my daughter. And I have a son, but it was the daughter, just because she was at that age, that six-year-old age. And she kind of took the blunts of all of our deployments. I really thank goodness we have a good relationship now, because I really worried about that.
So it was back and forth with you and your husband deploying.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, well, my husband was an airline pilot, so he left home and came back.
Got
we were
it.
Sort of on this ebb and flow. But I'm the one that deployed for periods of time, and he kept the home fires burning, which was unusual back in the day. But when I would come home, I didn't feel, and that really bothered me a lot. And so, you know, you have a little glass of wine, you know, to try to get that edge off, which was not a good way to cope with it. I'll just say that up front. But it was the ability to reconnect with being a mom that I found so challenging. And the more you deployed, the harder it was to do, because it was just easier to stay in the unemotional mode. Because if you're going to turn right back around and deploy again, you don't want to re-grieve, if you will, leaving your family. So men, remember you say, well, dad just needs some time in the garage, or he just needs some time at the basketball court, or he just needs to go out with his buds. I mean, that's expected of a guy. Give your dad some room, right? I mean, that's kind of a common thing. But mom.
You walk in the door and it's what's for dinner.
Mom,
and
yeah. Moms don't get rooms. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. They don't give us much breathing. Mom, here you go, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was the one thing that I found very challenging was the ebb and flow. And it's just a funny story. I went into education after I retired, and educators are the huggin'est people I've ever met. And to this day, it still bugs me when people hug. I said, you know, we don't go out and go, oh, good flight, hug. We just, you know, we don't do that. And so that emotional, you know, that closeness and that, you know, ability to show emotion is tough. But anyway.
Having mentioned the airline so much, it's funny because I have seen multiple times male soldiers walk onto an airplane and have someone say to the flight attendant, will you buy that guy a drink? I've seen women soldiers, and maybe I've just missed it, but I haven't seen people make the same offer. I mean, do you feel like even just walking around during active duty, women get less respect maybe than they are due?
I don't think you get less respect. I think in today's society, women have integrated in all walks of life. Mm-hmm. And I think the public is more accepting of it. I think the generation like that my son is in, or even 10 years beyond him, because women sat next to you in the engineering classes and women were whipping up on you on the soccer field. And, you know, women and girls, if you will, have really integrated into all of society. I think sometimes it's expected that it's a male. And then sometimes I think women are kind of seen in awe. I love the commercial that was done where the female gets on an airplane and people applaud for her. And I just thought, oh, yay. And that's the one thing. A lot of times if you watch commercials, the Super Bowl or some of, you know, you watch the Final Four here and see when they go to show military commercials, a lot of times there aren't women in them. Mm-hmm. So it's our fault in the military for not portraying women, that we are an integral part of the military, which we are. I mean, today's service could not be done without women in the service, period. Get over it.
What we just have a little over a minute left. What do we do for our neighbors and friends and people who we know who are returning, women mm-hmm. in particular? How can we help out? Do we call up and say, hey, can I watch the kids next week? Or what?
That's great. There are basically three things you can do in your local community for vets. First of all, is just recognize them. I think that's, you know, it's a saying of thank you, buying you a drink, shaking your hand, you know, acknowledging their service. That does mean a lot to us. Number two, as I talked about before, is if you have the ability to hire a vet. Trust me, work makes them well. Work makes our warriors well. And three is if you have someone in your community, some nonprofit or not-for-profit that's working with vets, donate to them. You know, donate to their cause and let your contributions then, you know, exponentially go out into the community and work. And so those are the three things that we tell our listeners and our folks that really want to help vets.
And people can look at your website and find out not only how to help, but how to receive services if they're in need. Is that right?
Absolutely. GraceAfterFire.org is our website, and we'd love you to come visit. And thank you for letting me be on today and talking about my favorite subject of veterans.
Well, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to have you.
Take care, Chris.
Kim Olson retired as a colonel from the U.S. Air Force and today serves as president and CEO of the not-for-profit organization Grace After Fire. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Any comments, questions, or suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.